You're listening to CFBU 103.7 FM's program focused on contemporary issues and ideas that are defining St. Catharines and the broader Niagara community. You're listening to Niagara Voices and Views.
Here on Niagara Voices and Views, we have often had conversations with different individuals and different organizations who are either playing a role in defining what the city of St. Catharines and often the region of Niagara is, but also are often the movers and shakers in terms of making things happen and having specific visions about what that could be and what this place could be. One of the earliest interviews we did on the show was with the artist Elizabeth Chitty, and then not long after that we talked to Stuart Reed, the director and curator of Rodman Hall. And I mention them because there's something that's coming up this Friday, although it's also something that involves not just the notion of the arts and cultural spaces, it also touches upon some of the ideas that we talked about when we talked to Adam Durant from the Workforce Planning Labor Board about how a city can be and how we see a city and really how you sort of invent or reinvent a city. And this Friday there is a panel happening called Reinventing the Downtown Through the Arts, and we're going to be talking about that in the next little while here on Niagara Voices and Views. The person who is moderating that panel, although I'm never sure if I want to call it a panel, because I mean it could be a panel, could be a symposium, and these become very interesting because there will undoubtedly be questions from the audience. But the person who is moderating that panel is Assistant Professor Sherilyn Ingram from Brock University, who's in the area of the Center for Studies in Arts and Culture. So, Professor Ingram, thank you for making time to come on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Bart.
This is a topic that is very hot right now, and it's a topic that we've seen talked about in an extremely positive way, and we've also seen it sort of happen. Well, I think anyone who listens to the show knows that we often end up mentioning events that are happening as part of Art is in the City, which is part of this initiative as well. But it has also led to some discussions about gentrification, whose city is it, all of those questions that come up whenever you change a place. And so could you tell us a little bit about what the topics will be, how is this discussion going to go, and why some of our listeners should show up and attend this and also be part of this?
Well, what we're trying to do, I think, is exactly to address some of the issues that you've just brought up. And I hope we'll have a chance to talk about some of the reasons why culture is being looked to by municipal, provincial, and even federal authorities as one of the growth areas, a place for investment for all sorts of social and political reasons, not simply for aesthetic reasons, which is how those of us who come from the cultural sector tend to frame the discussion. But, you know, part of the whole move to the downtown by the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts and the collaborative project with the First Ontario Performing Arts Centre was really the outgrowth of what I think was the first ever municipal, maybe I shouldn't say that, but I'll say it's the first really significant investment at the municipal level in St. Catharines that is really looking to culture as a potential economic and social driver. And the panel that we've put together, I think, is going to be a really, really interesting exploration of some of those possibilities. As you mentioned, I'll be moderating it, but our panel includes Michael Leckman, who's with Diamond Schmidt and was the lead architect in the adaptive reuse of the Canada Haircloth building. And I think the symbolism of adaptive reuse for cultural purposes is huge. It has meaning on so many different levels for so many people. So Michael's going to be addressing some of the decisions that were made, the reasons why, the ongoing connection with community. How is this going to... This is not an isolated box. This is designed for the city to interact with Brock in a really meaningful way. So we'll have Michael. Then, as you mentioned, we're also going to have Stuart Reed. God knows, we are so fortunate. We are so blessed to to have Stuart in St. Catharines. He's one of the most intelligent and courageous curators of contemporary art, and I think one of the most socially responsible. And he's going to be looking at some of the innovative ways in which art and artists can interact with particularly urban issues in a way that highlights them, makes us all see them in new ways, and possible applications here in St. Catharines and the Niagara. And then finally, you mentioned Elizabeth Chittis, who again, in terms of the resources that the Niagara has, I think we sometimes underestimate, because Elizabeth is a hometown girl who came back home. She came back home after being one of the most significant movers and shakers in the national and international art world when it comes to new art forms, particularly the 80s, and is a woman of international renown in that world. She's back in St. Catharines, and she's taking all of that background and applying it to very innovative art projects, which again look at sense of place, sense of history, sense of how people fit into place. So I think they are wonderful examples of how an investment in culture is an investment in social cohesion, in social awareness, and just plain the excitement. You know, one thing that probably you didn't address with Elizabeth, because why should you? Elizabeth was one of the pioneers in terms of Queen Street West in Toronto. And your concern, or the flag that you raised about gentrification. The last time I talked to Elizabeth about this subject, we were laughing a bit because she said, you know, in many ways, gentrification is sort of the last issue of concern when it comes to downtown St. Catharines. Let's get to the point where we can worry about gentrification. So I'm not quoting her exactly, so consider those my words rather than Elizabeth's, but stimulated by Elizabeth.
One of the points I would make is that Elizabeth comes to this with a sort of sentiment that in some ways is about a history of site, and a history of site, well, you know, her exhibition, Confluence Field Trips, is up right now, and that's a show that very much talks about histories and naming of places and official histories versus what I would maybe call secret histories, although not necessarily something that's hidden, but simply the way that things change over time. And that's also something that when we're talking about an area or talking about the downtown or the history of St. Catharines, that when we think about how once upon a time it was defined as one of the industrial engines of the country, and now that has changed, and now the mythologies and the stories change with that. And I think when you say that this is a very unique project, it is. I know from having lived in other cities across the country that sort of seeing this kind of venture being made between the downtown, between civic politicians and sort of civic spaces and a cultural space and a university space is a very unique thing. And the gentrification question is always interesting because having lived in cities where you do see spaces and individuals who are forced out or changed, your point about St. Catharines and the downtown, there are points, I think, where you have to sort of make decisions and understand that moving forward is always going to mean change and that there are always going to be individuals and groups resistant to that. I think maybe it's even something that we can think of in terms of a generational space, because if you think about how some individuals define this city and define this space, that change is always an unwelcome thing. And it can be a bit painful, but at the same time, what it also means is that you suddenly have a downtown that has been revitalized in a very immediate way.
Your mention of gentrification, and particular reference to other cities in Canada, I think is a really interesting one. And we're lucky in that we have other models to look to. Certainly, where we see this approaching a crisis is where you have an extremely hot real estate market for reasons that go far beyond levels of cultural activity. And the common pattern that we've seen, certainly in Toronto, also to noteworthy effect in Vancouver, lesser effect in Calgary, starting now in Hamilton, is that artists move into depressed areas because that's where they can afford to live and work. And that, to simplify the process, makes the area trendy. and ultimately the artists are priced out of it. I mean, that's the classic model that's followed. One of the courses that I teach at Brock is cultural policy, and I'm really interested in decision making that has an impact on creating an environment in which cultural activities contribute the most to society, not merely forms of creative expression, but forms of social engagement that really shape people's understanding of themselves and their community. And I go back to Vancouver, and this sounds like the most bureaucratic statement in the world to make. Vancouver benefited immensely because the cultural affairs department was housed within the planning department, which meant that during this time of extraordinary pressure on real estate. So, for example, when developers were applying for easements on municipal regulations to extend a footprint of a building by 2 inches, the cultural folks were right there within the planning department, able to say, it seems reasonable. However, the price tag that the city will require for this is that the main floor of this development, it must be dedicated to a contemporary art gallery, and an endowment must be set up by the developer to fund that for 20 years. Or one of my favorite examples with regard to condos is, yes, this appears reasonable. However, two of the condos must be deeded to the City of Vancouver, and we will award them on a competitive basis every 3 years as live-work spaces for artists. So that's the sort of example where you can get municipal planning, understanding that drive towards gentrification. But if you have values and intelligence, I think you can make the points work together. And I think the second point I would make is that we need to look at these issues within a much broader context. It's not merely about appearance of a built environment. It's about the whole question of how our economy is changing. Now, you've talked about St. Catharines as a former industrial hub. My perception has been St. Catharines really, like Hamilton, has gone through a period of really feeling like a failed resource to some extent with the loss of that industrial, or the diminution at least of that industrial base. And what writers like Richard Florida have taken a broader look at is the whole socioeconomic change in North America, at least, towards knowledge workers. So a less industrial base, a greater emphasis on knowledge workers. And if you say that we really need to look at society in its broadest sense, that's another way in which the cultural sector is extraordinarily important. A few years ago, the region of Niagara did an economic impact study of culture, and they found some really, really gratifying results in the sense of those of us who work in the sector sort of believed it intuitively. But one of the most interesting of their findings was that 73% of Niagara's cultural workforce has a post-secondary degree. That's compared to an average within Niagara's workforce of 19% with a post-secondary degree, and an average within Ontario's workforce of 29%. So if you put that picture together, to some extent, investment in the cultural sector is an investment in the long-term health of the knowledge working element of society. So that's not specifically what we're going to be addressing in the panel discussion on Friday, which I think is going to be a lot less statistics and a lot more lively in terms of ideas. But it's nevertheless part of the background we should understand to this type of discussion.
And it may also be that when we're talking about the title, Reinventing the Downtown Through the Arts, it's always good as well to keep in mind that a city is actually defined by its people. So we're not just talking about these buildings, although I do very much like when you mentioned earlier how Michael Lechman will be talking about reconfiguring or reusing one of the buildings that's already there that was part of the industrial history of this city and turning it into part of the next sort of chapter, but also understanding that the people who make up this city are a big part of it. I think when you're talking about how there's other models to look at, that's a very good thing because it also kind of indicates how this situation in some ways is very different. There have been some arrows shot regarding notions of gentrification, but having lived in a city where that hot property market that you talk about defined everything. And so I could use an example of a couple of artist-run centers in a city I used to live in that got tired of constantly having that cycle happen and purchased a building with the assistance of the Saskatchewan Arts Board. And then when the area they lived in then became gentrified, a variation on what you talked about with having offices close to each other, so decisions were being made in a more open way or with a perhaps different set of ideas, that once you became a property owner within those spaces, it allowed you to shape how that space went. It comes with problems, but it comes with possibilities. And so therefore, all of a sudden that you are a property owner in that space, and therefore you will not be moving, means that you get to define how that gentrification or how that vitalization or revitalization will take place. And that's something I think that we need to think about because, again, when you talk about the education factor, that's just another way, I think, of speaking about how the city has changed and therefore certain structures have to change with it. And whether that be the structures in a physical sense or the structures as we sort of think of them. Because I also think, too, I had a conversation with Elizabeth about how both of us had left this place and then coming back and sort of seeing it in different ways. And I joke to people that I just treat this city now as a completely different city than the one I grew up in because it simply has changed that much. And it has become something that sort of willfully reinvented itself. And I say willfully because a lot of times things simply happen and simply don't, and you wake up one day and that's what you are in a space. And that can be good, but then it also means that you haven't necessarily controlled it. And Adam Durant from the Workforce Labor Board talked a little bit about that in terms of being aware of what you can take advantage of and what trends are there. When you say it probably won't be as statistical. Will the individuals be speaking of their respective individual experience? Will they be talking, I guess, maybe this is the real question, about where they sort of see things going 5 years from now or 10 years from now? Because we're talking about this as a new chapter. So let's play that game of where it might be in 5 years.
Well, I certainly wouldn't presuppose with the answers that Michael or Elizabeth or Stuart would give to that. But definitely, the discussion is meant to be future-oriented. And we are trying to bring in examples from elsewhere that will stimulate ideas and discussions. The possibilities are really huge. I know I've talked to Stuart about what he's going to be bringing forward, and he has some examples where artists have been addressing the situation in Detroit, which is far more drastic, certainly, than anything that we have faced. But some of the artistic interventions and the outcomes are really, really exciting. So the idea of bringing in ideas from elsewhere, but I also believe that artists, I always hesitate to cite Ezra Pound, but antennae of the race, right? Cliche, but I'll use it. Nevertheless, when you're facing periods of social change, when you're desiring some transformation, I think looking to artists who should have the critical discipline of their background and their studies, but at the same time bring a particular personal perspective that you really can look at things differently. And a good part of the session on Friday will be engaging with attendees. We're hoping that some of the statements are going to be sufficiently controversial or at least...
Exciting.
Exciting, that they will invite reaction and exploration and further ideas. I mean, what we're looking for is we want this discussion to be a catalyst for further thought about how the interaction between the cultural sector and the downtown, in particularly St. Catharines, but this has application across Niagara.
I like that term, the notion of it as a catalyst. I like that a great deal. And I don't mind the quote of Ezra Pound, but most people will tell you, and this perhaps connects back to my time on the prairies, that sometimes my secret modernist comes out. But I might also sort of throw out, and this maybe also references to my time on the prairies, that I would, for example, use, say, Louis Riel's line when he talked about how the artists among his people would lead the way. And that's something that when we think about where we're going and how we do things, that it's probably safe to say that we want more of a sort of collaborative approach with these. I am sure there will be some exciting and engaged comments in terms of talking about these things, because it's quite funny sometimes, because looking at it from the outside at points, there is definitely a kind of envious nature from a few other cities looking at what's happening here, just purely from the point of view of the civic involvement and purely from the point of view of the civic support of that, and how you sort of see this play back and forth between it. But I think at the same time too, again, whenever you're sort of moving forward, there is going to be that kind of resistance, because when we talk about other models, one of the ones, one you cited was excellent in terms of BC. I would cite something like Calgary, where for the city art program, the whole idea that if a building was being built and it was above a certain amount of that money had to be put towards a kind of public art space or public art competition. And that's really no different than when, say, Jeff Birch was here talking about, and he didn't so much use the term creative city, he was focused more on the notion of a livable city. But I think that's the same thing. And it's also the same things that, say, Jennifer Wallace talked about when she was talking about how with the Mayor's Arts and Culture Advisory Committee or Advisory Council, they were talking about how there needs to be more money invested in these spaces for many of the reasons you cited, but also because in the end, it is sort of indicating what cities are going to become if they're going to be good spaces. And not, it's always so easy in terms of citing Detroit, but it is also a very good harbinger, you might say, of what not to do. So the format, I imagine, will be each individual sort of presenting, but you said you really very much hope to engage from the audience.
Absolutely. And it's a pretty classic panel discussion format. I'll do the introductions and a few contextual remarks to get it established. And then we will hear from Michael, from Stuart, from Elizabeth. And then we have reserved a good amount of time for discussion from the floor. And quite frankly, if the audience proves to be somewhat shy about bringing forth questions, I already have about five in my back pocket. I'm sure we're going to have a good discussion happening.
Before we get into the specifics, so our listeners will know the when, where, and all of that, I should say that some people listening to this may be thinking that that isn't a fun thing to do. I think we're so used to sort of being spoken at times, but one of my fondest experiences, you had an organization called Finding City that dealt with a lot of the same issues in terms of art projects that were about mindful and positive urban living. And then there was a public art mural graffiti project called Street Meet. One group had a panel, and then the other group had a panel 2 days of each other. And what I enjoyed was that I was technically on the panel for Finding City, but I think I spoke more at Street Meet. And I think, you know, individuals like Professor Cameron Cartier or an amazing artist, Justin Langlois, who works in the public sphere, they were technically on the panel for Street Meet, but they spoke more at Finding City. And it became this really wonderful, respectful space that really was about asking questions and troubling. And I mean troubling in a good way, where it's, what does this mean and who does it mean it for?
Well, going back to the question of being talked at, I think one of the things you can look forward to is, given that this is happening at the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts, believe me, it's not just talking. There's going to be some mind-stirring imagery as well tied to the presentations of each of our speakers. So I think, I won't call it visual eye candy because it's more substantive than that, but certainly there's no way you're going to be able to fall asleep while being spoken at during this panel. And I think for all of us, I mean, Elizabeth's artistic practice is a really good indication of an artist who is really, really committed to the well-being of the broader society, and in trying to use her own artistic practice to address issues and stimulate ways of thinking about it. And as a matter of fact, I had a very recent experience. One of the other courses I teach is entitled Creating Social Value from Material Culture. And last week I took the class to the St. Catharines Museum, where the director, Kathleen Powell, spent a couple of hours with the students. And part of what she, as she was walking us through the type of material culture that the museum holds, she was also explaining the significance of the Welland Canal and the history of the Welland Canal. And all of a sudden, this light bulb went on for me and for the students, which is the actual physical placement of the building we're in, what we call the raceway that we cross over to go to the First Ontario Performing Arts Centre, actually was a raceway tied to an earlier Welland Canal. And we mentioned that, and Kathy said, well, yes, Race Street is named Race Street for exactly that reason. And it was quite fabulous for me and for the students, many of whom are from St. Catharines, to suddenly get those connections. And I think a lot of Elizabeth's work is meant to make you look and think and consider. And if you, in a city the age of St. Catharines, there is a layering that goes back to the basic natural history, to the presence of First Nations, and then all of the historical layers. And we should all be enriched by a knowledge and an understanding of that, and knowing how we can use that depth and complexity as a place to start to look forward.
And I think it's also something that gives us a far better understanding of the situation we are in now, that when we're talking about what has gone before, it can only help us understand where we are and where we're going. I mentioned too that with Elizabeth's work, there's always a sort of privileging of other people's voices and other people's participation, and that's something that's fascinating. And I think that's also something that when we're looking at how a downtown is reinvented, how a place comes to be. I very much like to think about places in terms of metaphor. So when we're talking about the downtown, the buildings are just a part of it. All of those things you talked about, the memories, the ideas, and the history that made that place also is occupied within that space. And so it's something that's really, really necessary to know. And it kind of comes back to how when I've written about Elizabeth's work, I think about the secret history of places, but not secret in a way that's hidden. But as you say, things get built upon, or it's just the fact that as time goes by, we sometimes forget certain things and need to sort of pause for a moment and look and consider. You mentioned briefly some of the details about this panel symposium, what I'm hoping will turn into a kind of intellectual free-for-all in this respect. But tell us the specific things we need to know if our listeners would like to attend.
The panel is being held this Friday, January 29th, from 2 to 4 p.m. It's in the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts. Formal address is 15 Artists Common. I didn't know that existed until recently. Anyway, the old Canada Haircloth building that we have reclaimed and re-inhabited, and it's actually occurring in room 156, which is immediately adjacent to the theater.
I'll be sharing information about that on Niagara Voices and Views Facebook page, too. Sherilyn Ingram, Assistant Professor at the Center for Studies in Arts and Culture, and the person who will be chairing the panel, Reinventing the Downtown Through the Arts, this Friday. Thank you very much for making time to come on the show. This has, I'm going to be selfish and say that this has been wonderful for our listeners, but I've enjoyed this a lot as well, so thank you.
Well, thanks a lot, Bart. I appreciate the opportunity, and I, too, have enjoyed the discussion.
I'm Hannah, and these are your cultural events for the week of January 27th, 2016, as brought to you by Niagara Voices and Views. This Thursday evening, January 28th, there is a public reception at Rodman Hall Art Center at 7 p.m. Sean Surface's solo exhibition, Inland, is curated by Stuart Reed. The artist explores the toxic potential of oily black as it infuses the ground, almost extinguishing the incendiary bars of hot red and yellow that burn like a surface in the bottom quadrant of several of these paintings. Manipulating the liquidity of paint, the artist creates wet layers, crackling surfaces that illustrate the alchemic properties of the material. Surface addresses environmental issues in these works, the uneasy pollution of materials seeping into the unspoiled cells of pure color. This world is in dramatic flux, churning and changing, each painting evidence of an arrested state of human-made unbalance. Amy Friend's solo exhibition, Assorted Boxes of Ordinary Life, also opens in public this Thursday evening. Inspired by a small found archive of personal photographs, documents, and objects, Amy Friend presents a new body of photo-based work that considers how identity comprises both fact and fiction. Composing images by overlaying fragments of the archive with anonymous secondhand photographs and her own original photographs, she infers narratives from the minimal details the remnants provide. Ambiguous and morphing, these composite images at once explore and confuse the history they reference, and Friend uses this to reflect on how we understand and interpret the people around us. When anomalous threads appear and begin to unravel the fabric of stories we think we know, we call into question what is accepted as truth. So little can say so much, and even greater is the unexplored mystery of spaces between what is known. The final show that will have a reception this Thursday is Visual Appropriations and Rewritings. This is curated by Katrine Parer and Sean Surface. Students in the Brock University courses Intermediate Paintings and Interpretive and Critical Writing in the Arts reflect creatively on well-known artists' writing and offer a visual and textual panorama of reinterpretive views. The exhibition will then travel to the University of Innsbruck, Austria, in June 2016. Gallery hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday and noon 5 p.m. Saturday and Sundays. Rodman Hall is located at 109 St. Paul Crescent, St. Catharines. Brock University's Center for Studies in Arts and Culture is pleased to present a panel discussion titled Reinventing the Downtown Through the Arts. This will take place this Friday, January 29th, from 2 to 4 p.m. in the Lecture Praxis Room, MW156, at the Maryland I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts at 15 Artists Common. This is a public panel discussion to present successful examples of urban regeneration through cultural activities. The participating panelists represent a variety of sectors within the arts community. Visual artist Elizabeth Chitty, creator behind the Confluence, Walking Projects and Exhibition, architect Michael Leckman, architect of the Maryland I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts, and the curator Stuart Reed, director of Rodman Hall Center. Studies in Arts and Culture faculty member Sherilyn Ingram will moderate this illuminating public talk. All are welcome. On January 29th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m., you can also attend Active Citizenship, Drama and Education and Applied Theater Symposium in room MW156, Maryland I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts, 15 Artists Common. This is a symposium on the role of drama and education and applied theater. We'll be exploring concepts of citizenship, community, and care as they relate to living with others in structured and unstructured spaces. This keynote will feature Kathy Lundy with a response by Jonathan Nealens. This is a free community event. Cinema Political Brock is pleased to present a screening of Discordia when Netanyahu came to town in the Mate Community Room at 245 St. Paul Street. This will take place on January 29th at 6 p.m. It's September 9th, 2002, and a scheduled appearance of Benjamin Netanyahu, the former Israeli Prime Minister, has sparked heated debate in Montreal's Concordia University. By the end of the day, the Concordia riot has made international news, from CNN to Al Jazeera. Discordia documents the fallout from the event day. Following three young campus activists as they negotiate the most formative years of their lives, check out Cinema Politica Brock on Facebook for more details. Saturday, January 30th, singer-songwriter Lisa Marie Kruchak will be performing at Mate Cafe and Lounge at 241 St. Paul Street in downtown St. Catharines. Kruchak has been playing music in Toronto for the last 10 years, crafting moody folk songs played with her distinct percussive guitar style and compelling vocals. Kruchak grew up in Winnipeg, engrossed in the vibrant music scene. She drew inspiration from her hometown for this album. Kruchak says, "When surrounded by prairie, there's a feeling of being small, surrounded by vast skies and grasslands. Being lonely in such a big universe, yet feeling at one with nature. A very serene feeling. I wanted to try and recreate that feeling sonically." I'm Hannah, and these have been your cultural events for the week of January 27th, 2016, as brought to you by Niagara Voices and Views.
You're listening to Niagara Voices and Views, a program focused on contemporary issues and ideas that are defining St. Catharines and the broader Niagara community. We're inviting you not only to listen to Niagara Voices and Views, but also to get involved and help expand and enrich the conversation about issues in this region. We're looking for researchers, writers, reporters, producers, and hosts to work with CFBU in an environment that will provide experiential learning and skills development. CFBU is excited to help you find your voice about the issues that matter to you and your community. We're always looking for input and opinions. Check out Niagara Voices and Views on Facebook or email us at talk@cfbu.ca. We look forward to hearing from you.
We often have said on Niagara Voices and Views that we invite your feedback and your questions. And one of the things we also invite and really appreciate are suggestions about things you would like us to cover or things that you would like NVV to highlight and sort of treat as an issue that maybe is one that isn't getting the attention in regular or mainstream media that it deserves. So one of our listeners suggested that they'd like us to cover or talk about the notion of a guaranteed annual income or a guaranteed basic income. It has a couple of different names. And this is something that we've skirted with a few past guests, and it's something that we've talked a little bit around when we've talked about other issues such as poverty or housing or tenuous employment. So in light of that, here on the show, we reached out to Glenn Walker, who is the new chair of the Niagara Poverty Reduction Network, to ask what exactly it means and how exactly it would happen and why this is something that's getting attention from a number of different quarters. And this is something that the Niagara Poverty Reduction Network has talked a little bit about recently and done some workshops on. So this week on the show, we sat down with Glenn and asked some questions about what this means. When people talk about, or when people use the term a guaranteed annual income or a guaranteed basic income, what do they mean? What are the models that they're looking at? How would it actually happen? Because we've heard it bandied around quite a bit. But if the government tomorrow was to say we were going to enact this, how would it look? What would it actually be? And why is it something that a lot of people are touting as a solution to aspects of poverty? As you say, not the only solution. There never is just one.
That's right.
But what is it? How would it work? And why would it work?
Sure. Well, it's definitely, I think the idea behind basic income guarantee is really good. It's kind of obvious just by the words. It's really saying all citizens would receive and be eligible to receive a basic level of income that would ideally keep them funded above the poverty line so that they could get their day-to-day ability to pay their rent, their food, other expenses covered off so that they can focus on things such as, higher education, looking for better jobs, their children are in better daycare, better nutrition. So overall, what you find is a much healthier community. And at the same time, it creates a solid safety net for people. Like right now, we've got our social safety net is a bit like Swiss cheese in many ways. You know, we've got funding for children, child benefits. We've got funding for seniors through our old age security and gains. The bulk of that sort of working population, there's not a lot of social safety nets. You know, we do have a ODSP, the Ontario Disability Supports Program. We have work programs, that type of thing. But generally, there's no one program that says, you know what, here's what you need to live on, and we're going to provide this to you. I think the concept of the basic income guarantee is to say, well, if everybody got this base of funding, we wouldn't need all these other programs with all sorts of criteria and rules and governance. It's basically saying everyone would get this. It immediately makes sort of administration of the whole thing easier. And at the same time, it does allow people the stability to kind of move forward with their lives. We find so many people that they're working, they lose their position, they get forced into poverty, living below that that line. And all of a sudden, you know, there's mental health issues, physical health issues that come up. And generally what we're targeting here in the region is people living in poverty think, well, you know, it doesn't affect me, I'm working. But in fact, it's been estimated it's costing the system well over $1 billion in extra services, programs, health care costs. And if we had a basic income guarantee, so many of those people would be experiencing better health, better employment, better mental health issues as well. So we wouldn't necessarily be taxing these other systems that individuals have to use. So this concept of the basic income guarantee is really trying to give you that ground floor base sort of funding for everybody in the community.
So it also sounds like it's something that's not so much a preventative measure, but more so something that is addressing a situation before problems can start that are addressed in other ways. When you talk about healthcare, it makes me think of when, for example, I would speak to other individuals who would talk about how if you're on a very low income, it's something that affects your health, and at the same time, you are unable perhaps to care for yourself or care for your family in a way that ends up taxing the healthcare system more so.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you think about you know, the fact that you know, so many people have higher rates of dental care need. You know, I was talking to one lady just yesterday, and she was talking about, you know, when she slipped into poverty, she can't get dental care. The program she's on will allow for extractions, but no preventative care. So, you know, here you've got people who with extreme dental health issues. That translates to physical issues. We see as well people who are, you know, experiencing all sorts of issues, such as poor nutrition. All of a sudden, you look at higher rates of cardiovascular disease coming up in that population as well. So it really has a significant impact on our healthcare system. You know, the incidence of mental health problems is dramatically increased as well. So overall, we really find that those secondary costs, we never think about it in terms of sort of here's the cost of people living in poverty. And the basic income guarantee concept is really trying to say, well, yeah, if we're providing this to people, it is preventative. So you're quite right. It really does jump ahead of these problems coming up in people's lives as they move down sort of that path of struggling with limited income and supports and services.
I'd also go back to a really excellent example that a previous guest talked about on the show when you're talking about essentially the working poor, or that term that is so often used in terms of tenuous employment.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that when you are in those situations that, for example, if you're given the choice between paying your rent or paying for your car to get to work, and then something else happens. When you mention dental issues, that's something that often hits people in a very unexpected way, and it's not necessarily something you can budget for. And then when you don't have a safety net, and I do like your analogy of it being like Swiss cheese, because there are certain things that are there, but there seem to be more holes than there is anything else. Mm-hmm. What are the models that have been in place in other places for this, and what are some of the things that would tell us how it would work?
Well, I think there's it's sort of been piloted in different places across the globe. There was a project in Winnipeg actually that was looking at this issue, and that program ran for a few years in through Alberta Public Health. And I think that they were really looking at an experiment trying to see what would happen if indeed we move forward on providing this on a sort of at least on a pilot basis. What's the outcomes? And really what they found through providing this pilot project was that it really did improve overall health of the people who were participating. People were able to go out and purchase their basic needs. And what they found is that it actually reduced that stigma of living in poverty as well. So that mental health component was reduced as well. I think one of the things that people keep talking about as well, if you give people money, you know, like it's something that is going to cost our system. Well, in fact, what we find is that when they ran this pilot project, and when they ever do these sorts of pilots, people actually go out and they spend those monies on food, clothing. So they actually are returning that back to the local economies. So, you know, overall, it's a plus to local communities in terms of reinvigorating them as well as supporting those people who have received that type of assistance.
I'd actually inject 2 points there in terms of what you're talking about in terms of putting that money in people's hands, or actually maybe providing them with space so that they can sort of then take that and put money they would have otherwise that would have to go towards rent into the larger community. One point that a previous guest made from Start Me Up Niagara, but also it was sort of echoed by people from the John Howard Society, is that having a safe place that you can live in, that you know you're going to be there as long as you need to be there, and that is a supportive environment, allows you not just to sort of deal with any anxiety issues when you talk about mental health and the sort of worry, because when we're talking about tenuous employment and paying your bills, mm-hmm. that's something that everyone worries about, and so that, of course, affects everything around you. I would sort of quote a previous guest who talked about how we don't always talk about how tenuous employment can stress families in whatever form they are because of not knowing necessarily where the next meal is coming from and all of those sort of concerns. So it is something that if you have that security, you can go out and get a better job and move forward. And one of the other things is when you talk about how it's giving people money, and this is undoubtedly one of the criticisms. Sometimes it's rather sad in some ways how mean-spirited some individuals can be. But when you're talking about how these people will then take this money and then spend it in the wider community, it is a big point, because if you don't have to worry about spending your money on rent, you can then go and shop, and then you can then go and do things. And I don't mean frivolous shopping, but in terms of buying your groceries or buying things for your children or for your family that in the end stimulate the economy.
Well, absolutely. You know, you really, and it's a direct injection into the local economy. It's not like, oh, I've got money to invest in stocks and all this. It's a real infusion into the local economies of resource and funds. And you're quite right. If you've got stable housing, if you've got a stability in being able to purchase good food, those things are huge drivers of mental health, stability, and wellness. You're right. It does create that opportunity then to get further education, obtain more reasonable work situations for yourself as well. A basic income guarantee really says, here's the funds, spend it as you see fit. And what we find is that people spend it on realistic life items. It's not a frivolous, I'm going to go wild and do crazy things with it. But rather, I need the basics. I need a good place to live. I need good food. I need good health care and health care supports. Ideally, to be able to even save something and provide better education for your children, prepare for that. So there's a number of things that can fall out of having this basic income guarantee that we see sort of inklings of from some of our other social safety nets. But with this concept, I think the idea is that it really provides a blanket for everybody, and it's not sort of conditional on, well, do you have a disability, do you have this, and do you meet this eligibility criteria? It really is saying everybody is now eligible to receive this level of support.
The Niagara Poverty Reduction Network has done a few open houses answering questions about this. I know that there was one that happened in Pelham, and I believe that there was one that happened in Grimsby as well.
Yes, we've been doing some talks on talking about the basic income guarantee across the region, and we hope to continue to do that as part of our sharing information on a number of poverty-related issues.
So you've just stepped in as the new chair of the Niagara Poverty Reduction Network, and this is something that definitely has been getting a lot of attention. The workshops you've been doing, sort of putting this idea of a guaranteed basic income out there and making sure that it's getting attention and that people can sort of ask questions about it, and sort of to use a line I like, making it an adult conversation about mm-hmm. this proposal and not just making it a sort of knee-jerk reaction, as we've kind of alluded to here and there. But what are some of the other initiatives that you want to see happen during your time as chair of the Niagara Poverty Reduction Network, and where do you want to see the organization go? What do you want to be able to look back and say that we accomplished in terms of your time as chair?
Well, I think the network, actually, we're having at this point in time, we're kind of revisiting kind of like, how can we clearly articulate what our purpose and goals are? And I think a couple of key goals for us is really providing the opportunity for residents, business, and organizations to know about poverty's root causes. We're really trying to focus ourselves on providing education and information. So that's where we talk about programs such as the Basic Income Guarantee, and we talk about transportation programs and issues, provide examples of other programs that work not only here in Niagara or that could work in Niagara, but across the country and across the globe. So we're really trying to get that information and education out there to people. The other areas that we're trying to focus on as well is really working with all the members of our community, not just not-for-profit organizations, but businesses and other groups that meet and work to help support people, and really look at how can we support collaboration? How collectively can organizations, individuals, businesses say, is there something we can do? And it's a call to action to say, let's work together on an issue. No one organization can solve a problem. And I think what we've been sort of talking about is there's a number of sort of band-aid short-term solutions that we have in place that help people. But then there's sort of these larger issues about, well, how do we create better economic environment, a better housing environment for people, a more effective healthcare system? So these become larger issues. And I think collectively in Niagara, what we're trying to do is, it's a call to action of, okay, here's a number of issues that are out there. Here's some solutions. Can we work together and sort of tackle a number of these issues to coordinate our efforts to help fight poverty in the region and really bring people to a point where they are earning a nice living wage, that they are not going to really suffer a lot of these traumas and issues that we've been talking about. The other piece, of course, is that not only are we calling it action, but also the advocacy piece as well, really trying to influence our decision makers in terms of making decisions around resources and allocations. We've been part of a national movement, really, to kind of say, we need a national poverty reduction strategy. We need to look at how this issue can be tackled, not only in Niagara, but across the country. And then as well, what information do people really need to know? Well, what are we dealing with here in Niagara in terms of unemployment, the number of children living in poverty? And then what tools can we use to effectively make change? So the network really has a broad membership, and we're trying to work with all of our community partners to kind of move forward and tackle the education information component, providing opportunities for groups to work together, and then as well to be an informative voice for policymakers in terms of, here's what we think is going to work as you're developing policy, as you're developing priorities, here's something to think about, and maybe you can put that into action in your work as a politician or as an organization that is really looking at wages for staff and sustainability of their organization in a community. So we have some very broad goals, and I'm hoping that with our collective work, we're going to engage a lot more community partners than we have in the past. We already have a very significant membership, well over 30 organizations. But we've been talking about how do we engage businesses more effectively, other community groups, and individuals who have real life experience. It's so important for people to hear what some of these stories are, to really get a face to the people and the struggles. And everybody has their own unique story. And how can we make a broad policy decision and put a real face to it and say, here's the impact it's going to have on somebody? I think that's really kind of what we're hoping to accomplish in the upcoming years with the network.
And I think as well, when you're talking about putting a real face on it, it actually makes it more about how this is our community as a whole, and that these are individuals within our community. And even the whole idea of a guaranteed basic income is in a way sort of offering element of support so that individuals can be more fruitful members of the community, and so that they can therefore do more and contribute more. So this is also something too that is really very much about improving society as a whole and sort of looking at where we would like to be as opposed to where we are. And I guess one more question is that, you know, because we have had a shift in government at a federal level, and it has been that point where it's been long enough that some of the honeymoon is over, as some of the media pundits will say. But I've asked some past guests who work in the same area as the Niagara Poverty Reduction Network if they think that there is going to be sort of more of a change, because over the past 10 years, some of the attitudes and some of the ideas, and I don't mean to sound partisan, but just simply from the fact that you saw money cut at a federal level that was cut at a provincial level, and the joke, of course, is that the civic levels have no one to actually hand that down to, so they must deal with it. So do you think there's going to be actual change now? Do you sort of look and think that a year from now we'll see some genuine policy changes at the federal level that will address some of the issues you're talking about?
Well, certainly I think the messaging we've been getting from the new government is that exactly, is that we are interested in hearing what's happening at the in relation to poverty. We are looking at sort of the social, our net of care. I think if we look at providing sort of on the concept of sort of a basic income guarantee, even the shift back on our old age security and CPP, looking at rolling that back to age 65, it does talk to that whole concept of we do need to be supportive of those people that may not have a sustainable income as they move into retirement. And I think that kind of echoes perhaps that attitude that we may, that we're optimistic that we're going to be seeing relating to the younger population, children, people in the workforce as well. So I think we would be able to say, yeah, I think we're optimistic that we are going to be able to see some movement on these fronts. Clearly, we've got a number of great organizations. Obviously within our region, I think the Poverty Network is one of a few networks across the province that really I've been impressed with in terms of how many people come to the table and how they want to work together. So I think there's an energy here that will really engage well with our regional politicians, our provincial, and now, I think optimistically more with our federal partners as well as they move forward. So I think we're looking, with rose-colored glasses to the future and going, well, I think, there are some opportunities here, and the network is really trying to put information together and arm our politicians and that with really good information about what the picture looks like in Niagara and some possible solutions that we think will work for us.
I think maybe I would call it cautiously optimistic, maybe because it is one of those things where, as you say, the messages that are coming out seem to be talking about that. And I think, perhaps sort of to put it in a different way, it was interesting to gauge how talk of deficits or running a deficit was less of a concern. And I'll go to civic leaders again on this, because one of the ideas that has come up again and again when talking about these issues of poverty reduction, whether it be with yourself or with John Howard or even with Positive Niagara, that you see things happening at a civic level. But one of the things that was interesting is seeing civic leaders, whether they be mayors or individuals like yourself who occupy advocacy spaces, sort of responding positively to the idea that a deficit is not a huge deal if that money is going towards building up a part of society and assisting a part of society that we need.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I think what we always tend to forget about is that at the provincial or federal level, there's one big pot of resources. And the issues around poverty are sort of tapping into a number of different programs and funding streams. But at the end of the day, the overall cost, when we talk about deficit, it's not really going to hit our system perhaps as dramatically as people would envision, because we aren't then tapping into extra health care and issues around more people being incarcerated or people falling on the other side of the law, people suffering with housing issues. So overall, I think as we look at better costing of some of these projects and programs, if we had some more, up-to-date programs and strategies, it would allow us the opportunity to release some of the older programs and the funding associated with them and say, how can we reorganize and refresh our social safety net? One would hope that by developing a national strategy or a better provincial strategy on poverty reduction, and those types of things would be looked at, and ideally look at the resource base we've already got in place and how we can better and more effectively work with it.
Glenn Walker, who is the new chair of the Niagara Poverty Reduction Network, thank you for answering some of our questions about what a guaranteed basic annual income would look like and talking a little bit about some of the ideas and some of the issues that make it look like something that we should maybe consider in terms of our society. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You've been listening to Niagara Voices and Views on CFBU 103.7 FM, truly diverse radio broadcasting from Brock University. We hope you've enjoyed this week's show. Niagara Voices and Views is your show that talks to diverse groups and individuals within the Niagara region. We talk about the ideas and issues that help define Niagara. Past episodes of Niagara Voices and Views can be heard online at cfbu.ca, or you can find them at our Facebook page. We're pleased you chose to join us for this week's episode and hope you'll be with us again next week on CFPU 103.7 FM, Brock Radio.